Hi, I'm Elise.
I'm Matt, and welcome to Pod Race, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. If this is your first time joining us, we're two friends watching Star Trek Deep Space Nine and sharing both our deep and irreverent thoughts on our favorite Star Trek series.
This week, we're talking about Season 5, Episode 18, Business as Usual, teleplay by Bradley Thompson and David Weddle, and directed by Alexander Siddig under the name Siddig El Fadil, which is his actual name. Business as Usual aired on April 5th, 1997.
This week on Deep Space Nine, Quark's cousin Gayla offers him a job as a weapons dealer. Oh, cousin Gayla.
I love cousin
Gayla.
The
much talked about.
Yes.
And now, this is the first time we've met Gayla, right? But we've heard about him. Mm-hmm. He did try to kill Quark previously with the shuttle that was going to blow up when they time traveled back to Roswell, New Mexico. But
I love that Dex calls that out. Like, isn't this the cousin that tried to kill you? I am going to preempt your asking by just saying I did not remember anything about this episode.
Yeah, no, totally fair. This was one of those cases where, and it's funny because I was talking with some friends this week about they're trying to figure out which episode I had shown them, and we were trying to guess, and I'm like, oh, is it this one? And like this name from like TNG or Deep Space Nine.
Right.
And then my other friend was like, oh, I just watched the one where Picard was captured by the Romulans with the four lights. I'm like, oh, Chain of Command. That's not to be this guy, but that's technically the Cardassians and blah, blah, blah. And I was like blowing their brains and I knew all the names of these episodes. However, this was a case where I saw the episode title before I rewatched the episode. I'm like, I don't know which one this is. And then I was like, oh, it's the like holographic weapon sales one. So like I remembered the plot.
I just didn't remember the name associated with the title.
Yeah, right?
I got you. Yeah. I'm not as good at that as you are. You've also been watching Star Trek a lot longer than me. But like I can imagine not connecting that. Because business as usual, like you have the word business in the title, but that does not necessarily mean it's a Ferengi episode, but it makes the most sense that it would be a Ferengi episode because the word business and Ferengi are like synonymous.
Well, yeah, because just you look at the title and it's like, oh, is this the crossover episode with like Bachman Turner Overdrive because we're taking care of business? Like, what? I don't know.
Every day. So this was Alexander Siddig's first time directing. I think he did a great job. I thought the performances are really good. Haggith is properly scary. The Regent is a piece of shit, and Armin did wonderful in this episode.
Yeah, I think I was when I was doing, you know, the cursory glance around the internet for quotes and things like this. This was one of, I think, Armin's favorite performances as Quark, because Quark got to truly be like a three-dimensional character in this episode and like be faced with a moral dilemma and challenges and just, you know, it's a very multifaceted portrayal of Quark in this situation.
I do wonder if, like, say the Cardassians, like, still, like, were in charge of Terek Nor or whatever. Obviously, this would not be a show, and we wouldn't know these characters if that was the case. But I do wonder if Quark's moral line, I'll say, would be different under those circumstances. Like, is he influenced by being friends with Dax and by being around the Starfleet, and that's why he is uncomfortable with so many people dying? Or is that just like Quark being Quark? Like, obviously, if you're a bartender, you are probably not, like, I would like to think that you chose to be a bartender, you probably don't think murdering 28 million people is a good idea. But like, we would never know. And it's interesting to think that his environment might have helped influence him, be like, this is probably a bad situation I'm in.
100%. And like, I think that is, you've keyed in on one of the strong kind of themes or undercurrents or whatever of the episode, where like really the question of this episode is like, how far does Quark's greed go?
Yeah.
And are there limits? And if there are, what is it, et cetera, et cetera? And I think, too, it's like we're, what, almost five seasons done, you know, almost six seasons into the show. And it's like, yeah, It's like the root beer conversation with him and Garrick, this whole famous one, where it's like, if you drink it enough, you find out that you just might like it, root beer being the allegory for like the Federation, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, TLDR, yeah, you're 100% correct, right?
Yeah, and I just think it's really interesting. Like, we know, like, 28 million people dead is, like, above his limit, but I am curious what the lower end of his limit would be. Like, would he be okay with, like, 5 people dying? Would he be okay with 100 people dying? You know, like, I'm curious what that level is, and I'm not saying this episode needed to have figured that out. It's just something I am thinking about personally. I do think that the B plot is needed in this episode because the A plot is so serious that the B plot like helps lighten up the episode a lot for me. Plus it's so cute to see the little baby Yoshi. That being said, it's very much feels like, oh, it's another episode where it's like where Keiko's not there. I think we only get Keiko like one or two other time, like one more time in this show in general. I did want to mention when they were talking about the weapons in the episode, there's a lot of references, actually besides the weapons, there's a lot of references to different movies, and I'm not going to go through all of them, but I will say that there was one reference which I found really amusing. I got this from Memory Alpha because I haven't watched this movie in a long time, but when they're doing like the Hollow Suite like customer, you know, showcase thing, and Quark says it's like a Breen CRM 114. That's a reference to the CRM 114 device found in the B-52 bombers in the film Doctor Strangelove. So I'm gonna have to maybe rewatch that movie this upcoming week.
Gentlemen, you can't find here. This is the wall room.
I haven't watched my copy of it yet, but I bought that either last year, I think, on one of the Criterion sales. So I really should rewatch that film. It's one of my
favorites. I don't have a Criterion of Strangelove. It's been a long time since I've watched it. I'm probably overdue for a rewatch. But I do have it is a steel. It is a steel book. So it's not as bougie as a Criterion, but it's not bougie.
I mean I'm gonna be honest, I don't even remember what the like extra features on the disc were when I bought it, but I did rewatch it on streaming within the last like 5 years for sure, because I think when HBO Max came out, it might have been on there. So plot B is very silly, as mentioned. It involves O'Brien and Yoshi, the baby. Yoshi is missing Keiko, who they always come up with like a reason why Keiko isn't there. In this case, she is on Bajor dealing with a blight. Babysitter's unavailable. Jake offers to babysit. That's not really going to work because this baby will not stop crying. I personally believe that he started crying because O'Brien was talking too loud as he left the quarters. but the joke is that the baby cannot leave O'Brien's side because as soon as he is not being held by him, he starts crying. I did find it really funny that O'Brien was going to like throw darts while holding the baby.
And Julian's like, you already have one bad shoulder. Like, yeah, come on, exactly. Bro.
At one point, Bashir does like a bunch of tests on the baby to find out what's going on. And I'm just, and like, obviously, like, babies just fucking cry, dude. Like, calm down. But it really made me laugh when Bashir was like, perhaps he's become prematurely aware of life's existential isolation. I thought that was so funny. So good. I loved it.
O'Brien's like, wait, what do you mean?
Yeah.
And then Julian's like, well, I just think it means he'll be a really good poet.
Which is funny because I think what he really means is he's just a baby that's crying. Like, there's nothing wrong with him. They do find eventually by putting Yoshi in like what they call the pit in ops. there's like, it looks kind of like a baby Yoda like thing, but not like floating. He's just the baby sitting in there, and everyone's just like whispering around him, and it's so funny. Like Sisko whispering to him like about this, and O'Brien being like, can we wait until he's awake to move him, was just very amusing for me. Like, I just, the idea that Sisko like played along with it, because he also, I think like if Sisko wasn't a parent, he would not have gone along with this. Like, Sisko probably remembers what it was like trying to calm Jake down when he was a baby. There is one more scene in this plot that involves Worf, and he comes to tell O'Brien, like, hey, you were supposed to be doing XYZ. And O'Brien's like, yeah, Sisko told me to take time off, so I am. And Worf's like, to care for your son. And I immediately was like, Worf, you wouldn't know anything about that. and brutal. Which I felt immediately bad for, because Worf later is like, I wish I was around for Alexander being a baby. And I'm just, and like, he really was robbed of that. I will not deny that. But yeah. Like, since you've found out about Alexander, you've not done the best job taking care of him. So my feeling bad about it only goes so far. But I will laugh. I will say I also found it funny that Yoshi does not cry when Worf's holding him. And I wondered if Yoshi knows that Worf delivered his older sister.
Yeah, I'm just impressed that Worf remembered he had a son.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I was thinking as well.
You know, the bar for father hit for Worf, you know, doing something positive as a father is... pretty low, but you know, we'll recognize it when he acknowledges it.
Right. So our main plot, Quark loses all of his money in some like Ferengi stock exchange type of situation. I don't know what it is. And he stupidly put the bar up for collateral with three different brokers. Money is due in a week. He's playing tango with Jax when he finds out this information, and he's basically like, it's like when you're playing games with your friend and your friend like won't get off of their phone, and then you find out it's because your friend lost all their money in a stock exchange. And I did laugh at Dax being like, it can't be all that bad. And I'm like, okay, Dax, I absolutely love you, but like, you don't rely on money for your livelihood, so I feel like you maybe don't get it. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying, like, she's playing it down, and I don't think she realizes how serious it is.
it's kind of giving a little bit of, like, you know, rest in peace, Maggie Smith, but the Dowager in Downton Abbey when Thomas is like, oh, I can come over on the weekends. Exactly. Exactly.
What is a weekend? Yeah, it just feels very rich person dealing with, like, oh, it can't be all that bad, you know? I'm not saying that, like, people in Starfleet are rich. They just, like, don't use money, so it doesn't matter to them.
Yeah.
This is when Cousin Gala shows up to help. He's played by actor Josh Pace, P-A-I-S. I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce that. And we get reminded that no one's allowed to do business with Quark. The Ferengi Alliance has banned this from in a previous episode. So,
Brunt, FCA.
Oh, yeah. Josh Pace, that's how I'm pronouncing it, played Raphael in the 1990 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie, which I absolutely love. Raphael is not my number one turtle, but he is great.
Wait, who's your number one turtle?
Donatello. It's just like, he's the best one.
I was a Raphael kid.
Of course you were. Did you watch the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem?
No, I haven't yet. No.
5-star film. I'm not kidding. And Raphael is fucking great in it. You will love him.
Nice.
It's wonderful. Nice. And Ayo Edebiri voices April. So it's just wonderful.
Oh, nice.
Love.
I didn't know that Gala was Raphael until you just said that.
I mean, I didn't know that until I saw it on the internet, so. That was like a research. I have to look up like
OG clips because it's like there was something for. Sorry to talk over you, but there was something somewhat familiar about the cadence in his voice, and that's probably it.
That's really funny.
Or if I'm seeing this episode before, but.
But also, one other thing I read about it is Josh was the only person who did the voice and physical acting for that for their turtle in that movie. The other turtles had different people doing the body and the voice, if I recall correctly from the research I did. So he did he played the whole character. We learn that Gala is a weapons dealer and he's offering Quark a job. A job that he's offered him in the past, but he has turned down for various reasons. One of which is it's not a people business. And Gala says that this specific job is about wining and dining customers, something that Quark will be great at. And I will admit, Quark is so good at this job, honestly. He will supposedly get all of his debts paid within a month. And he's going to get 5% of the profits, which he thinks is very low. But once he sees what the profits are, he's like, oh, yeah, 5% will be plenty of money.
One of the things that, like, I appreciate or find interesting about this, like, setup of the plot. And like you said, ultimately, it's about, like, what depths will Quark go to? But this whole situation really kind of keens into how there is a direct line from someone's material conditions and access and availability to like wealth and, you know, money and power and all of this stuff. And like when that's taken away, how there's a direct line to folks engaging in riskier and ultimately illegal behaviors to survive and try and stay liquid and like stay afloat and like I said, survive. Because Quark's back is, you know, very much like against the wall. His life is what he has is he's going to lose and it's literally going to fall apart. And then he gets this opportunity that he's a little hesitant for, has had said no to in the past, but
he's more desperate.
He doesn't want to be destitute.
And it's not surprising that he feels like in his moment of panic about what he's going to do with his life, it's not surprising that he takes the first offer that comes his way. The money seems like it's going to be very quick and very hot, like a big amount of money. And he thinks it's going to fix all of his problems.
Well, and even, like, the ways in which, what's it called? I'm going to say. Where Gala, like, is aware of Quark's situation and then knows that this is his time to basically, like, be predatory and get Quark involved.
Oh, totally. Right? Totally agree. He's definitely taking advantage of him. I do want to mention that there's this one scene that I think is fucking hysterical where Quark is talking to Gala and he's like stomping on the floor and like shaking
the stools
and Gala's like, what the fuck are you doing? And he's like, Odo could be anywhere.
It's like he just walked by 5 minutes ago.
I know. It's so funny. It's like, and
but he's tricky.
And it was made even funnier to me because last night I watched the 1933 version of The Invisible Man for the first time. And I don't know. Yeah, it's so good. And like there's a scene where they're like debating how the police are like discussing how they were going to like catch him. And they have this like mesh net that they're holding up, like they're all like in a row and they sweep like the whole room with the mesh net like to make sure that there's no invisible person in the room before they start talking about their plans. And this felt very similar to like Odo being like checking around him that Odo, you know, for Odo.
Yeah. Fuck, I should
Claude Rains is like so, a little baby in that movie. When they show his face at the end, I'm like, oh my God, he's like, his skin is so like young looking. That was great.
He's, That movie's so gay. Anyways, okay, cool. We love James Whale, don't we, folks? That was the James Whale one, wasn't it?
It was. Speaking of James Whale, I also watched Bride of Frankenstein the other day for the
first
time.
Favorite movie.
I never had seen it before.
Oh, it's so good.
I think we watched it first. I watched it sometime in the last, like, 3 or 4 days. 5 stars. I absolutely loved it. I decided I want a Grumpy Sunshine romance with the bride and the monster. So, like, the bride would be the grumpy and the monster would be the sunshine. Because the monster just doesn't like fire. He's sweet otherwise, in my opinion.
See, my favorite thing about that movie is, like, it's clearly a gay man and a lesbian that were set up on a first date and just couldn't, like, we can't. Like, you know, and yeah. It's like, yeah, I do like, you know, get a little pedantic when people are like, oh, the bride, oh, Frankenstein, oh, we're these cool goths and hubby got a Frankenstein and I got a bride of Frankenstein tattoo. I was like, have you even seen the movie? She screams when she sees him. Like, anyways,
I also feel like they like spent a lot of time like convincing the monster that he wanted a mate, and they could have spent some time with the bride doing the same. She didn't get the hetero indoctrination that Frankenstein.
She
that
wasn't
the
sent to conversion camp.
Exactly.
So my fun. Sorry, I just really like Bride of Frankenstein.
Oh no,
so
it's
I'm
so good.
I am
thrilled about
it. Bride of Frankenstein, and especially, like, you know, with Pretorius and all of that, was one of those cases where I didn't know James Whale. Like, I didn't know a lot about him at that point when the first time I saw it. And I didn't know that, like, you know, I knew he was a director. I knew he had done some of the other, like, Universal monster movies. But I didn't realize that he was essentially living as an out queer man in the 30s, like making these movies, right?
Yep, totally.
And which is like fucking boss shit, probably did, you know, impact his career negatively as a result of that at the time. But I'm watching Bride and Frankenstein, and that's when I realized that my gaydar transcends time, because I'm like, this movie is so gay. Like, even the way, like, especially during the Praetorius scene with the monster in the, like, crypt or whatever, where he's, like, setting up the, like, picnic shit. And I'm like, was James Whale gay? And, of course, yes, because of all those other things I did. And I was like, fuck yeah, my gaydar transcends time.
I'm very proud of you. You did a great job.
Thank you.
Did you listen to the You Must Remember This season about Bela and Boris from 2017?
I have. I've been meaning to, like, re-listen to it. It's been a minute.
Listened to it, like, a week or two ago for the first time, and it was really great. So I learned from that James Whale was gay, if I recall.
Yeah.
That was really good. You should definitely give it a re-listen.
You watched This Old House, right, recently? The other
this
James
dark,
Whale, like
this
dark house, dark
yes,
old house, or
yes,
yeah.
I did, and I loved that.
Yeah,
it was really good.
This has been James Whale Corner of Podlings. Now back to our regularly scheduled podcast.
So back in the Star Trek world, I'd be remiss to not mention that Gala's partner, Haggith, is played by Steven Berkoff, who I personally know from the film Octopussy. He plays Orlov in that, which is funny because Orlov makes me think of Orlok, which is Nosferatu, which makes me think of Dracula, which makes me think of Frankenstein. So it all comes back.
Sorry, go ahead.
No. You go.
I did want to just specify, as we were just talking about, like, you know, queer cinema history, that when we say Haggith is Gala's partner, we mean business partner.
Oh,
we
yes.
We don't mean
yes.
partner.
No, we do not know Haggith's sexuality, and that's fine. They are business partners. Steven Berkoff has been in a lot of films, but he does so good in this role. He is honestly terrifying.
Such a good job.
He's unhinged at times. You don't know if he's going to murder you or hug you. I was very impressed.
I haven't seen Octopussy in, fuck, probably, how old am I? Probably like 25 years.
Well, I recommend watching it.
It's not one that I revisit, because the first time I watched it, I wasn't like super into it, to be honest. But I'd probably do a rewatch. But it's funny that you mentioned that, you know, he was in it, because he does give like good Bond villain vibes.
Oh, totally. I would say that there are parts of this movie that feel very Indiana Jones-ish. So I think you should definitely watch it again.
I'd be in an all-time high as I watch it, though.
You will, because you'll be thinking about the song the whole time. I will also say that there's a circus in it, which is fun, and
that I remember the opening sequence.
And actually, it was Desmond Llewellyn's favorite Bond movie to do, because he got to like go on location and like be in the plot.
I mean, if you ever want to see Roger Moore in clown makeup in an opening sequence of a Bond movie, like Octopussy has everything you ever wanted.
I know, it's so good. Yeah, I like it. It's great. I love Bond. There's only two Bond movies that I genuinely dislike, and that's not one of them.
Okay. Let me guess. You Only Live Twice.
That's gotten higher on my list.
Living Daylights?
No, neither of those.
Okay.
You Only Live Twice.
License to Kill?
No. You Only Live Twice has actually gone up in my last few watches.
With the massive caveat of, you know.
You know what?
The ways in which.
Oh, yeah. It's awful. There's yellow face. There is pretending to.
Yeah.
But this is a big, big but, obviously, because like that, those are all horrible things. The yellow face is in less of the movie than I had remembered. Like, it's.
Right.
Yeah. It's not great.
So what are your two least favorite?
Diamonds Are Forever.
Okay, yeah. And Her Majesty's Secret Service?
No. Are you insane? That movie's amazing. On Her Majesty's Secret Service is my fourth best movie.
Oh, no, fair enough.
Die Another Day.
So Diamonds Are Forever.
Die Another Day.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Fair.
Yeah, bad. But Diamonds Are Forever
Diamonds
is literally...
Forever has a great song, though.
Yes. It is the best song for the worst movie. Like it would be on, like, the widest spectrum of, like, bad movie, good song.
Yeah.
But that movie is just... You know what its biggest sin is? Is that it's boring.
Yeah.
Like, it's not, like, offensive. It's just boring. Yeah, Die Another Day is just bad. Octopussy is a 3.5-star movie for me, and like very much somewhere in the middle. Anyway, yeah, most of the Bond movies.
What's your favorite Moore movie?
My favorite Moore movie is The Spy Who Loved Me.
Okay, yeah, mine too.
My favorite Connery is Thunderball. My favorite Craig is Casino Royale. Although, I will be honest, Thunderball and Goldfinger kind of, like, switch back and forth for best for Connery. On Her Majesty's Secret Service is the only Lazenby.
It's true.
Sometimes I switch between Tomorrow Never Dies and GoldenEye as my favorite Brosnan. And The Living Daylights is obviously the best, what's his face?
Timothy Dalton.
Thank you. Timothy Dalton. Anyway,
another one that ages very interestingly as a relic of the 1980s. Okay, cool.
Now that we've had James Whale Corner and James Bond, two James's corner, let's continue with this episode. So the plan is going to be that they are going to show the customers the weapons within the Holo Suite so that they never actually have the weapons on Deep Space Nine, and therefore not bringing the weapons into Federation space.
Clever.
Which I think is a really smart idea, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And Gala lies and says it's Quark's idea so that Haggith likes him, which I think was very funny. There's this interesting scene where Quark was like, hey, buddy, I'd really like to get my earnings now. And Haggith is like, I don't like my people to have financial difficulties. So I'm paying your creditors directly until you are paid up with them. And then you will get your money. This feels like indentured servitude to me. Not like, it's not like a one-to-one comparison, but I'm like, this is shady. And I get Haggith's point because he's like a control freak and he likes to be like knowing he can trust everyone. And if Quark is getting that money himself, he may not pay his creditors. But it's totally like creepy. He's like, my associates are like family to me. And I'm like, Haggith, you are reading to me like a creepy sugar daddy. Like, I don't mean that sugar daddies are creepy. I mean that he's specifically a creepy version of a sugar daddy.
1000%. And it's like, and where, like, I think we kind of key into that is the power dynamics. Mm-hmm. Right? And like, oh, it's just, it's so unsettling. And like, it adds to, like we were kind of talking about before, the riskier behaviors, the idea of being driven and then trapped because of your desperation. Like agreeing to do something out of desperation and then you're trapped in it, right?
Yeah.
And like you can't escape because like you are under someone else's control, right?
I really like how they show how complicated and Haggith is as a person, because there's a scene where Odo comes and gets Quark to question him, because no, they're not stupid. They know Quark is selling these weapons. And Quark is like, I didn't bring any on the station. You know, so he's being questioned by Odo. And so we get this scene where Sisko and Kira come in and tell Odo, you have to let Quark go because Bajor does not want Haggith or any of his associates like messed with, because Haggith supplied arms to the resistance during the occupation, and if it wasn't for him, they'd be dead. And I just, you get this feeling like, okay, maybe there were, for 2 seconds, you're like, oh, maybe he's not a horrible guy, but like, obviously someone selling arms is going to be good, or is going to be bad regardless of who they're selling the arms to, I feel like. And we get, on the other hand, this guy, Farrakh, who, was an associate of Haggith, has been found out to be doing his own thing. He was like fucking up on the job, and Haggith has summoned him and yelled at him for this, and is like, our relationship's terminated, bye. And then the next thing we find out, Farrakh's ship blew up, and obviously Haggith,
what a weird coincidence.
Yeah, exactly. So like, you know, Haggith on one hand can sell weapons to the resistance, which is helping fight an occupation, but on the other hand, he will murder you if you fuck him over. So like, this guy is not good. And Quark's starting to feel, I think, lonely, because none of his Federation friends will come to the bar anymore. They've probably been banned from patronizing the bar or talking to him. I mean, Dax ignores him when he tries to talk to her. She's pissed that he's selling weapons, and he's like, they're just defensive weapons. And I'm like, Quark, you can't possibly believe that. I think Quark's lying to himself at this point. I don't think he wants to believe that they're also like offensive weapons being sold.
Yeah.
There's one other scene that I want to talk about with regard to Haggith's like personality. It's that scene where Quark is showing him the whole, like, welcome that he's planned for the Regent. And Haggith is, like, pretending to be angry and saying, this is what you've made for the Regent. And Quark's just like, yeah, this is what I heard he likes. And then, like, Haggith, like, I guess, is, like, acting as if it's what he's seeing in front of him is horrible. Like, you did a horrible job with this. Like, it's not grand enough or something. And then he tastes his food and he's like, oh, it's delicious. And then acts like he was just fucking with Quark. And I'm just like, this is where I'm like, this guy is so unhinged. And then he's like, Quark, I love you. And I'm like, okay, this guy's like a psycho, honestly.
It's where it's like that idea of like the power dynamics and things like that. It's like, Do I want to say this? It is very manipulative and like abusive.
Oh, ways, totally. Right? Like, oh, it's completely manipulative. In the next scene, we meet the regent, who's played by Lawrence Tierney. I learned a little bit about this guy. He was on a TNG episode and apparently was very insulting to Will Wheaton while on set. And another time when he was on
the set... Who was a literal teenager at the time.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like season 1.
Yeah. And then another situation, he was on Seinfeld and he thought it'd be really funny to like hold a prop knife up to Jerry Seinfeld's. And he was never asked back on that show afterwards. Apparently his agent has been had been bailing him out of jail through his mid-70s. On a less amusing note, he did have a stroke shortly before shooting this episode, so he did have trouble remembering some of his lines, and I honestly think he did really well considering. I don't know if this is because of the stroke, but he really looked very stoic in his request for weapons from Haggith and Quark and Gala, and I think that added to the role, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, I think his performance is really good. I think I think, you know, he can be not the nicest dude, and I think he's, you know.
And Ira was really happy that he was on. I think he really liked him as an actor, so he was really happy that he got to be on the show.
It's like a classic, like, noir type heavy, like, historically. And I think he's in Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah, too, he is. Apparently pulled pranks on people and got in an argument with Quentin Tarantino at one point.
Well, I mean, I think getting in an argument with Quentin Tarantino is probably pretty easy.
Yes, I would think so, too. So to get back to his actual character, the regent wants to level an entire cities of his enemy, who I don't remember what planet or group of people that was toward, but he wants the death toll to rise to 28 million people. And like the difference between Gala, like sitting there with a calculator, basically trying to figure out, well, how many weapons are we going to need to do this, versus Quark, who just looks completely horrified about 28 million people dying, is just like such a funny difference. Like, they're different reactions. Like, yeah. Gala is just like doing his job. He's acting as if they're buying fucking knives, like spoons and cutlery or something. Like, I want to feed 28 million people. How many forks do I need to buy? Like, he's acting like it's the most normal thing ever. And to kill this many people, they're like, oh, we should use a virus as the weapon, because he wants the death toll to increase slow and steady. So instead of just like shooting 20 million people or poisoning 28 million people, we'll give them a virus and they'll die slowly. This is so fucked up. Gala is, like, ready to retire, and he wants Quark to take his place, so he does not enjoy that Quark is kind of acting all nervous and, like, acting like this is a big deal. And I was like, you'll get 10 million bars of gold pressed platinum to destroy a planet. Duh, no-brainer. Gala is just so evil.
So, yes, but what I did like about where this kind of goes after, when Gala's, like, not pleased that, you know, there's changes he's seeing in Quark, it's because he wants to retire and he's setting Quark up as his successor.
Yes.
And it's, like, he feels like his only way out, especially with Haggith being as violent and manipulative as he is to offer, like, Quark as tribute, right? So, like, Gala can't get out without setting up Quark as, you know, again, to quote, to basically be bag of sand when Indiana Jones takes the idol.
No, I get it. It just seems super fucked up that you're doing this to your family member, especially.
Well, but I mean, he did try and kill him last season, so.
That's true. That's why I said Gala's really evil. That's all I was trying to say.
Yeah, I hear you.
There's a scene where, sorry. So Quark has like a stress dream. Basically, everyone that he knows in Starfleet is dead. O'Brien's baby is dead. Like, Jake is dead. And Quark wakes up and is like, shit, what have I gotten myself into? Basically, he finally realizes, like, okay, I cannot live with this if I participate in it.
That dream was so well done.
It really was. I thought it was good. It was like kind of, it reminded me of, it was kind of like Sopranos level dream, I thought, which is like the highest compliment I can give a dream sequence in a TV show. I think this scene is put in here just to make a joke at the end of the episode, but Quark breaks into Dax's quarters to like give his Tongo wheel to her because he's going to, he like wants to say goodbye and she thinks he's there to bribe her.
Yeah.
But basically Quark realizes I have to stop this sale from going through. And he's like, the worst thing Haggith can do is try to kill me. But what, like, to try to kill you. He's talking to himself, like psyching himself up. And he's like, what's one life compared to the lives of 28 million people? And I'm like, Quark, yes, that is accurate. Like, don't let 28 million people die. Like, that would be really bad. I do like Quark's plan. He invites the Regent's enemies to, oh, sorry, I skipped something. There's a scene where Quark is telling Haggith, like, he, like, starts lying to him and making up his own story and says, you know, I can't get that weapon that we were talking about, but I can get this other weapon. It might take a little bit longer. I just need you to sell it to the Regent. And I really love Armin's performance here because you can tell Quark is nervous and has, like, rehearsed what he wants to say, and this is where I feel like he's almost talking the most, he's like the most himself, because he mm-hmm. says, like, when he's talking about the terms of this like new deal that he has, it's just, there's one line, I can't remember what it was, but his phrasing, it just feels like how Quark normally talks. So it's like he's resigned himself to, like, however this shakes out, it's gonna shake out, so I'm gonna just be myself. And he feels way more confident than, like, but it's clear to me that he's, like, acting because he is scared. And I just thought that it was just really good. The episode gets wrapped up pretty quickly, or pretty, like, neatly after this. Quark has invited the Regent's enemies and is going to do the selling weapons to opposing sides, which got mentioned at the beginning of the episode as something you can only do if you're very careful and blah, 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 blah. So, like, Quark is going to do this knowing that it's not going to work out and everyone's going to see each other. And the Regent and his enemies are fighting and firing on each other, and Quark just runs away, and Odo's security team runs to arrest everyone. So the threat has left the station. Gayla and Haggith have escaped. The Regent has not escaped. It's like they both put Hitman out on the other one.
Yeah.
And so the Regent is dead. And Quark admits to Sisko that he wanted everyone to find each other, to have the deal called off. I do love that Sisko continuously, like, lets Quark off the hook. I do think it's A, because, you know, 20 million people didn't die, but also Quark is going to pay for all of the damages in the cargo bay. So I do find it really funny that the episode starts with, like, Quark's in debt, and now it ends, and he's also in debt again at the end of the episode.
Well, you know, Quark prevented a war crime. A couple weeks ago, Sisko did a war crime. It's, you know, it's it all comes out in the galactic wash, right?
And then the episode ends with Dex and Quark playing Tongo. All is back to usual, which feels very weird that Dex would just forgive Quark so quickly after selling weapons to numerous people, but Star Trek's gonna Star Trek.
Again, it all comes out in the wash. Yeah, enjoyable episode. I don't think it's one of my favorites or, you know, the best or anything, but it's good. It's solid.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with it.
Did you like the episode?
I did. Yeah. I did really like it. I mean, it wasn't like the best episode ever, but I just felt the performances were really fun, and that always is something that I really enjoy. I thought that it was well directed, and good job to Alexander Siddig.
Yeah. Well, now it's time for the Altair Water Thirst Quencher. Altair Water first being mentioned in the context of Star Trek, but in Star Trek 3, The Search for Spock. Also a possible reference to Alta from Altair 4 from the MGM film Forbidden Planet. Elise, who are you thirsting for this week?
I did think it was kind of hot when Quark was getting the umax and moaning while Odo walked in to question him. But overall, it wasn't a very thirsty episode.
Keep going till you see smoke. Okay. All right. Yeah, it wasn't a particularly thirsty episode for me, so. But I do have a candidate for the most Star Trek thing of the episode, particularly the most Deep Space Nine thing of the episode. Where are Keiko and Molly? I don't know. They're on Bajor doing botanist shit. It doesn't matter. Don't think about it too hard. But the baby's still here. Keiko can go deal with an ecological crisis with Molly, but not the newborn. Why is Molly there? Yeah. Like, anyways, whatever.
Molly has specific information that's going to help fight the blight, obviously. I think that your pick is the most Star Trek thing of the episode, and I am going to back it completely. God forbid Keiko leaves Miles with both children. Only she can take care of both children at the same time.
Apparently. What about you? Who is your candidate for most
Star Trek? I'm just going to piggyback on yours.
Oh, okay. Cool. Awesome. Well, until next time, Elise, where can folks find more of you on the internet?
You can find me on Blue Sky Letterboxd, watching the movies of James Whale and others, and Storygraph.
And James Bond.
Yes. At Chicken Tendi, that's T-E-N-D-I. You can find links to my other podcast, Fang Bangers Pod, on Blue Sky and Instagram at Fang Bangers Pod. That's bangers with a Z or a Z.
Yeah, you can catch me on Blue Sky and Letterboxd at Mattyhugh, MattyHugh. You can catch us together on Blue Sky and Instagram at PodRace. And you can also email us at podrace@gmail.com.
Please remember to rate and review us on the podcatching system of your choice. Thank you again to our editor, Melissa, and DJ Empirical for our interstellar theme song.
And until next time, computer and program.
Bye.